We're live. Good evening. Thank you for joining us for the November 2019 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. My name is Mary Jean Sage, and I'm chair of the commission, and I'll bring the commission meeting to order. And I have a gavel tonight for some reason. Our first item is to offer public comment for anyone in the audience who would like to speak on an issue that is in the scope of interest of the Health Commission, but doesn't happen to be on our agenda for this evening. We would invite them to come forward and make their comment. Seeing none, let's go ahead. Next item is our consent agenda. Any items that need to be pulled from that?
Yes.
3-3, the minutes, I have an addition or a correction. Do you want to do that now or wait?
Can we do that now? Or do we need to? We can do that now.
Okay, under Commissioner Raymond, the Health Commissioner updates, April the 16th is not, we're not going to meet at the California Highway Patrol parking lot. It's the San Luis Obispo County Libraries.
And is that 2019 or 2020?
2020. Oh, yes.
Okay. Jean reads our minutes. I'm so impressed. Good for you.
Okay. What we can do is approve items 3.1, 3.2.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Mike. That's why we have you here. So I will entertain a motion to approve items 3.1 and 3.2, if anyone would like to do that. Bob, thank you. Commissioner Campbell, a second?
Second.
Okay, any discussion? Let's go ahead and do a voice vote. All those in favor of approving the letters of support to the City of Morro Bay and City of El Royo Grande, which are items 3.1 and 3.2, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, item 3.3, I'll entertain a motion to approve it with the correction as noted. Thank you, Commissioner Campbell.
Second.
Candace, thank you for the second. Any further discussion? If not, those in favor of approving the minutes from our last October meeting, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, this is the time in our agenda where we give a brief update, if we have any, from our last few meetings. So I do have just a couple of updates. Two months ago, we had an update on the vaping issue in the county. I'm happy to report that I think we see some significant positive things happening in the county with that. We have a number of our local communities that are considering updating their smoking ordinance. That, in fact, is why we're doing the letters of support to both Morro Bay and to Arroyo Grande. They're in the process of doing that update. They're not thoroughly done with it. Some of them have received first readings. They'll be moving on to the next ones. Mike had a couple of things that has happened with Juul, and I'm sure you've all seen the news reports about them. They're no longer doing some of the advertising that they were. So I think that's a positive sign. I would concur with Commissioner Campbell as he said this has to be a grassroots effort. We need to start at the bottom, and I think we see some good improvement where we really are doing that. I think we need to continue, though. It's a long road to get to where we need to be with that, and probably by the time we get there, there will be some other product out there that everybody is trying. On the vaccine issue, which was our last presentation, I think it's still, you can still get flu vaccines, right, Dr. Bornstein? It's not too late to get your flu shot. If you haven't, please consider doing that. There were a couple of pieces of legislation that our governor signed that have to do with the public health department starting to monitor providers that do a lot of vaccine exemptions. And I saw something come across my desk where actually the medical board has filed a complaint against a physician in Southern California, one who does, in fact, or has had a history of doing a lot of exemptions. So it does appear that they're starting to be some monitoring on that. So with that, that's the only updates I have. Anybody else have anything? If not, we'll move on to this evening's program. Our program this evening was put together by Commissioner Kleinman, so I will ask her to introduce the program and our speakers.
Thank you. So tonight we have three speakers who are going to talk a little bit about homelessness in Slo County, affordable housing, and some gaps that are existing. So first we'll have Grace McIntosh. She is the Deputy Director with Community Action Partnership of San Luis Obispo. She's going to talk a little bit about homelessness in Slo County and some of the barriers that exist to obtaining permanent supportive housing. We'll also have with us tonight Joe Thompson, who's the Chief Operating Officer with People's Self-Help Housing. He will talk a little bit about the importance of healthy housing and the pathways for connecting health and housing. And finally, we'll have Carolyn Berg, who's the Principal Analyst with the County of San Luis Obispo Administrative Office, and she will talk about the regional infrastructure and the Affordable Housing Strategic Plan and where the county is with the planning for the 2020 work plan. So first up, I believe we have Grace McIntosh.
Good evening. Thanks for inviting me. I am technologically not good, so bear with me, but Michael will help me out. So I am Grace McIntosh. I'm the Deputy Director at CAPSLO, and I'm also the Director at 40 Prado. And I wanted to talk with you a little bit about several things. Homelessness, of course, being the area that is closest to my heart, and really looking at providing you with some data, hopefully some new data, but certainly data that I think is relevant for what we're talking about, which is social determinants of health. So I'm going to briefly go over the point in time. And you're all aware of the point in time count, I'm assuming. So as you know, it's every other year. In January of 19, we did the most recent point in time, and we saw a little bit of an uptick. Lots of reasons potentially for that. As you know, it is a snapshot. It is literally a point in time. So you're not going to capture the fullest picture, and many times the idea is that this really represents maybe only 60% of the actual number of homeless individuals, which I would tend to agree with. The unsheltered population, of course, is huge. Really, the only options for shelter, other than, of course, the women's shelter and RISE that serves a very specific population, is ECHO to the north. They are now at 60 beds, and, of course, 40 Prado, which is 100 beds. There are no shelters, of course, as you know, in the South County. Age is another interesting one, but the thing that I wanted to bring up is a very disturbing trend that we're seeing at 40 Prado. Since we opened October 10th of last year, we have seen an 81% increase in individuals over the age of 65 who are frail. You come to our center, you're going to see a lot of folks in wheelchairs and walkers and oxygen tanks as the baby boomers have exploded and will continue to explode. There are not a lot of options for them as they become more and more frail. Many of them are coming to us because a spouse died. They ran through their savings, or they were evicted because the landlord wanted to raise the rent because they simply could because of the market. And now they have no options. So that's a very disturbing thing that we're seeing. Length of time, again, we do have folks that have been with us for quite a while in San Luis Obispo County, and their residence prior to homelessness was San Luis Obispo County. So even though at 40 Prado, we implemented this past spring an in-county residency priority, we're still seeing people come from out of county. However, now there is a 14-day window, and then they need to leave because we cannot serve our own county residents. And so we need to be looking at that. subpopulation, again, looking at the chronically homeless being our largest, and really this is the, you know, you hear people talk about the quote-unquote high-end users. These tend to be individuals who are chronically homeless that have multiple issues that they are struggling with. We also saw, according to the point in time, an increase in the number of veterans. Families, of course, have seen a large increase in sheltering. That's because we've really, in the last couple of years, the county has really done a tremendous amount of work in getting programs like Bringing Families Home, like the Supportive Housing Program, to really get those families into housing. And, of course, the key is case management, which starting in 2009, HUD began to slowly dismantle the number of case managers, focusing on housing, which is great. But as more and more people begin to see that housing by itself, if it is not accompanied by case management, is a real issue for many of these high needs individuals. So we're looking as a community to look at ways that we can begin to wrap folks with services once they are housed to keep them housed. The primary event or condition, of course, most of it has to do with income. Either they lost a job or they were evicted for a variety of reasons. Alcohol use, mental health is not in there, but it is certainly embedded in alcohol or drug use. Many of the clients we see are what we call dual diagnoses folks, which one of the programs I'll talk about briefly at 40 Prado deals with that. And here are the barriers, of course, money. We don't need to tell you housing is very challenging in this county, and it's becoming even more so. Even the quote-unquote affordable housing is still not something that many of our folks who are on limited income SSI, let's say, for example, I have people that are on SSI of $600 plus. What are you going to find for that? You're just not. The self-reported health factors. So here is where we get individuals that have multiple issues that they're reporting. Often the dual diagnoses of the alcohol and drug use as well as mental health conditions, which go hand in hand, post-traumatic stress, the chronic health problems, which we're so fortunate in having CHC on site. I'll talk a little bit about that. That's probably been one of the single most important things that we've had with 40 Prado, the success of 40 Prado. And then services currently accessing, of course, you'll see emergency shelter and meals is a big one. People still needing those basic services, which, of course, if you don't have that, how can you hope to then go up that Maslow's hierarchy if you don't even know where your next meal is coming from? So 40 Prado, how do I get my stats to come up? Little wishing it's supposed to do. Let's click it again. There we go. Oh, boy. Okay, see? Thank you. So, for the year at 40 Prado, and I want to preface this discussion is when we embarked on the discussion to build 40 Prado, we spent a lot of time in the community asking folks, what do you want to see? We know that we've got Maxine. We know we've got Prado. Those are way beyond their shelf life, and they didn't really meet the need. What do you want to see? The number one thing we heard, access. Access is a huge issue for chronically homeless individuals, for vulnerable individuals, that we need to have services there on site. Because transportation, assuming that some of these individuals are going to be able to make their appointments three times a week at County Drug and Alcohol, or even go through the maze of trying to get their primary care provider or their specialty care provider, is very, very challenging and contributed quite a bit to continued homelessness or kind of cycling through the emergency room, which I'll talk about in a little bit, county drug and alcohol services, county mental health services. So access, access, access. Whatever you do at 40 Prado, make sure services are there that they can access and make them around medical, mental health, and substance use in addition to basic needs. That really those three things had to kind of come together. So we think we've honored that commitment. In a year, we've served just under 1,500 unduplicated folks. It's a tremendous number of people, including 133 unduplicated children, 76 families with children, 23,000 breakfasts served, almost 29,000 lunches, about 39,000 dinners. Oops, I went backwards. Oops. 37,500 shelter nights, 4,300 children's shelter nights, and 55 warming center nights, a new high last year. 103 clients housed. Actually, that's gone up now to about 110 clients housed. Veterans. So this is through our SSVF program, Supportive Services to Veteran Families. So CAPSLO, as you probably know, is the lead agency for services from Paso Robles down to Avila and north of Avila. And Five Cities Homeless, under a subcontract with Good Samaritan, runs SSVF for Avila South. So these are this is data just for CAPSLO. 132 total households, again, in that one-year period, we enrolled the majority of them. And we placed 47% into permanent housing with an average time to placement from intake into housing, 65 days. We had a goal of 90 days, and we achieved it and then some. Way better than any other housing program. I think a lot of it is the way that SSVF was developed, with a focus on landlord relationships, with a focus on housing specialist positions, to really work with landlords to say, look, this is a veteran. He or she served our country. Take a chance, and you've got us for at least 6 months to support this placement, to be there if you have any concerns, to be there if you have any questions, that intensive case management to wrap around that individual once they get housed. You're going to hear me continue to talk about wrap around case management, because it is essential for success. So we're very proud of our track record. What is frustrating is VASH vouchers. So HUD-VASH is a separate program through the VA, and that is to house more chronically homeless individuals. So SSVF is more for rapid rehousing and eviction prevention. It is a short-term program. I don't think a lot of people are aware of that. We can serve for about 6 months, 9 months tops, but then we have to pull away. The idea is for the more chronically homeless individuals, there is the VA and the HUD VASH vouchers. So the VASH vouchers are very similar to Section 8 vouchers, for example, only obviously it has to be for veterans. What we're finding is those are not being utilized enough for a variety of reasons. A lot of it is the challenges in getting through kind of the bureaucracy, but it's also that the fact that, you know, in this market, I don't really need to take a voucher when I can get double. And that's really a challenge, and it's also kind of sad. But we have 46 VASH vouchers that are available and nowhere to use them. This is our Slow Hub project, so I want to talk about now the access. So we are into the beginning of year three of a program that we got through SAMHSA, and it was to really look at providing intensive mental health and case management services to 30 dual diagnoses individuals, so people that have that drug and alcohol and as well as mental health diagnoses. And these are the toughest cases that we have. These are chronically homeless individuals. It is a harm reduction model. So relapse is assumed. It is part of the recovery process. About half of the 30 people that we serve are at 40 Prado. The other half are out. We're meeting them wherever they're at, whether it's the creek, whether it's in the housing, whether it's in their car, wherever it is, hoping to get them either into services with us or just continuing to provide services wherever they are. It is a housing program. And so we've had, I think, tremendous success. We have housed 60% of these individuals in the 2 years that we have been in working. And again, the key has been intensive mental health. We have two therapists and intensive case management, two case managers working with these folks as they work through their processes to get permanently housed. We have 19 people on a housing wait list. Again, mostly through TIMAs, permanent supportive housing, and that can take a while. You're all familiar with the VI SPDAT? process? Okay, so I don't need to go into that. Hospital stays. So recuperative care. I was here a couple of years ago talking about that. It was a baby program at the time. Intensive medical. So these are folks who are coming directly out of the hospital. So Tenet Health, Dignity Health. The idea is to keep them out of the hospital or keep them from readmitting to the hospital. So SenCal Health just delivered, this is a one-year snapshot. Their whole focus is, look, they come to 40 Prado. They get wrapped around, again, intensive case management. CHC, now they're on site 4 full days a week to provide that primary care, full-service primary care, and help with linking to specialty care. So what they did was they took those patients, 54 members. Now, this is about 44 of our people. This also includes a small number from Good Samaritan that had just gotten kind of their program running, which is very different from ours, and Cottage Hospital. But 44 of the members are ours, and we will be getting our specific information. But what is interesting is they looked at the 90 days before they came into RCP. So of those 54 people, 79% had gone at least three times, an average of three times, to inpatient hospital. So inpatient is they're there more than, you know, one day. They're either in the emergency room and then they go in, but they're staying in the hospital. So almost 80% of them had spent three or more days in the hospital. And when they came to RCP, so that's the middle column, you'll see it went down to about 10%. And then the more interesting piece was 90 days post. So did what you did at RCP make a difference? And really our focus was to not just deal with the initial issue. So not just dealing with the person who came in with, you know, type 1 diabetes and amputated toe and COPD, but now looking at the onion layers, as we call it. The contributing factors that contributed to that individual ending up in the hospital. Oftentimes it was drug and alcohol use. It is mental health issues. It is PTSD. It is a variety of issues, but beginning to deal with that. Because if you don't deal with that, you're going to have the continued cycling in and out of the emergency room. And what we found was we were making a difference. It went from almost 80% to 27%. Of a reduction 90 days post. Emergency room, same thing. 96% of these 54 people prior to coming to RCP had utilized the emergency room almost three times during that 90 days. When they came to us, it dropped to 40. And then once they left 90 days post, it only went up to 46%, which according to SenCal was kind of phenomenal. These were high-end users. These were people that were cycling in and out of the emergency room. They wanted to see a reduction in emergency room usage, and we did it. We cut it by almost half. The focus, again, is linking people to immediate primary care, getting them to their specialty care, and then helping them to become their greatest advocates. We go with them to the doctor's office. Our case manager or our RN accompanies them, works with them to get them to better understand the process. Hey, Joe, write down the questions that you want to ask because you know you're only going to probably get 5 minutes with your primary care person. Teaching them how to advocate for themselves because this is a huge issue. It's hard enough for me to remember all the questions I want to ask my doctor, much less these individuals who are often very intimidated, don't really know how best to advocate for themselves. So this has been, I think, a huge success, and in large part, the connection with SenCal Health has been tremendous. The nurse practitioner is there 3 days a week. The MD is there 1 day a week, and we work very, very closely, and it has been a huge success for them as well. We're thrilled. The data points of notice, again, 52% fewer members had emergency room visits, 65% less inpatient, and 85% of members were connected to primary care or specialty care because many, many of these people needed specialty care. And we are seeing an increasingly the acuity of these patients. I'll give you an example. You know, we had someone who is a three times a week dialysis, type 1 diabetic, amputee, PTSD, been in and out of hospitals constantly. Blood sugar just could not be controlled. Often was going to the emergency room. He came to us. The emergency room visits lessened. His blood sugar got manageable. We started connecting him with the services that we need, and more importantly, the community connections, so that when he left us, he is now in our general population. He is learning that there are things in the community that he can now access, that there is support in the community for him. Is he going to get housed anytime soon? No, because his income is $960-something on SSI. But he is in a much better physical place, and we're working on him possibly going to live near his formerly estranged daughter, because that's the other thing we do. Try and find their connections. Try and find who out there could you possibly go and live with? Who could possibly be a support? Because the reality is, you're not going to get housed in San Luis Obispo. It's just not going to happen. And that may sound heartless, but it is the reality for many of our people. So trying to kind of figure out what can be the next steps for them through this program. And then again, the data points of notice, it was still working, even 180 days out. This was going to be a video that was going to kind of recap everything, but we kind of couldn't get it to work. So the biggest thing at Forte Prado, I think the success of Forte Prado has been that access to service. Do we help everyone? No. Can we help everyone? No. We are not the answer. We are not a mental health facility, although County Behavioral Health Services is in the recruitment stage now of having a full-time county behavioral health therapist who will be there on site 40 hours for the moderate to severe. We already have community counseling center there for the mild to moderate individuals. But we're not a mental health facility. We're not a drug and alcohol facility per se. Do we work on the harm reduction philosophy? Absolutely. Do we still have to look at the greater good and safety of our folks? Because we have children. We have fragile individuals, and we have seniors. So if you are under the influence, I'm going to be very clear about this. If you are under the influence, that is not a determinant to keep you out. If you are under the influence so much that you could potentially be a harm or a threat, that may keep you out, because we have to look at the greater good. We are full almost every night. Virtually almost every night, which is why we went to the county priority, the in-county priority. But I think we're coming a long way to providing that access, which is critical to helping these individuals find the next steps in their life. Any questions? Oh, I got to go one more, right? No? Thank you. There. Right?
Yes. I'm curious about your slide on the inpatient hospital stays and the way you've impacted that. It seems like there must be a really impressive cost-benefit analysis to that. Have you done that sort of a study?
Well, that was really why SoCal Health did it, because they really want to know, is this worth it? Is this worth our investment? I mean, clearly, you know, this came about 3 years ago because of the ACA requirement now that any hospital, if you've been readmitted within a 30-day period, you get fined. And so when the discussion started between SoCal Health and myself, the idea was, look, we don't want to see them in 30 days. So it was clearly a cost-benefit discussion. And for us, we thought, well, yeah, we want to do whatever we can. So really, we took our concept from the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless project, which is a best practice, really looking at wrapping intensive services around, but at the same time, supporting these individuals in terms of their ability and their comfort level about advocating for their own healthcare. This is a huge issue. Advocating for your health care, and then dealing with the maze of it. So that was their cost-benefit analysis. They have looked at the costs associated with the recuperative care program, and they see that it is definitely, now I don't know their dollars, they won't share that with me, but they were thrilled, and they said, this is doing what we had hoped it would do.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other? No? Thank you very much.
Not right now. probably later, though. Okay.
Good evening, and thank you so much for this opportunity. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about myself, my favorite subject, before I get into the presentation. So I've been working in affordable housing for about 30 years. I've seen the power of affordable housing to change lives. And that's probably the big message I want to make tonight. If you've learned nothing else from me, learn that. Whether it's in for chronically homeless person in Seattle who's in a harm reduction SRO in downtown, or whether it's for a veteran in Los Osos, or a farm worker in North County, or a senior in Morro Bay, it changes lives and it improves the quality of lives. So I moved to SLO about 5 years ago, and this is an amazing place that's changed my life. I'm much healthier for having moved here from Seattle. I've lost a little bit of weight, got rid of the little lamp I'd have to sit under during the winter in Seattle. So life is great. One of my neighbors up in Seattle, when I was discerning whether to make this move, was from SLO. And one of the things he said to me was really prophetic. And it was that really the only hard thing about living in SLO was figuring out how to afford to live in SLO. And that was pretty prophetic. And 5 years later, I'm still going back to those words of his. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about People's Self-Help Housing and how we've helped some people with answer that question for themselves. So I start with a quote: health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So really, at People's Self-Help, when we talk about healthy housing, this is really what we strive for every one of our residents. And it's a lofty goal, but I really believe it's an utterly attainable goal for each and every person that we serve. So a little bit about People's Self-Help. So we have 205 employees. We've got a $15 million annual budget. We serve three counties from SLO down to Ventura. We've got 50 properties. We've been in existence for, it'll be 50 years this August. We've developed 1,800 units of multifamily housing. We serve about 5,500 residents right now. We've built about 1,200 self-help single-family homes. So we have been busy. The need is great, though. So the importance of healthy housing, really, when a family lives in safe and healthy housing, it really impacts and changes every aspect of their life. So, when I have the opportunity to be out at one of our properties and I have an opportunity to hear a little bit and share a little bit from one of our residents and hear about where they came from, what their living conditions were and the stresses on their lives because of those living conditions prior to moving in, it's just absolutely staggering. And I'm sure everyone's heard of the substandard conditions, the overcrowding that folks have had to endure. What we talk about healthy housing, it's about giving folks an opportunity to have really mental and physical well-being, really to be the building block to be successful in all other areas of their lives. From the kids thriving in an environment where education and learning is possible, to just being healthier, having more disposable income to actually take care of themselves, to if they need to go to the doctor, they have the income to do that. If they have the opportunities really to improve their lives. And just, again, that stress that insecurity provides folks, to have that not be an issue anymore for them. So really there are four pathways to connecting housing and health. The first is stability. The second is quality and safety. Third is affordability. And the fourth is neighborhood. And each and every one of these are things that we strive to achieve for our residents. And each one of them really leads to better outcomes for those folks, and each one of them also have better outcomes for society. They save money in the long run. And just to kind of reinforce that point, so the cost of an individual living in affordable housing for a year is roughly equal to the cost of 3 days of hospitalization or 3 months in jail. So you get a lot of bang for your buck with affordable housing. So stability, a key concept is in health and housing is stability, and that's really equals length of stay. So households that move more frequently face a lot greater challenges in their physical and mental health. They're less able to create those sort of support networks they need, everything from consistency of doctors to neighbors that they can rely on, just all those things that you that a lot of us who have that stability take for granted. And so on average, families that rent, not low-income families, but just families nationally, move once every 20 months. And at Peoples, on average, our families move once every 8.3 years. So we really provide that stability that, again, that housing can become a building block for the rest of their lives. Quality and safety. So substandard housing, conditions such as water leaks, poor ventilation, poor air quality, all those kinds of things are a detriment to healthy housing. At Peoples, one of the things we're really proud of is the quality of the standards that our housing is built to, and that it's maintained going forward. And so every year, for instance, each one of our units, we do a internal inspection on our own to make sure that that safety and quality is there, that we're not missing things. And then at most of our places, there's also an outside inspection from a regulator. We also make sure that our housing is built with lots of welcoming community space, and so big, large community rooms that we can leverage to bring additional services and into our properties, and having making sure that our family properties have playgrounds for the kids and sport courts and things like that to really to promote not just physical activity but community building for our properties. So. Affordability, so a big one in California and a big one in SLO, as I mentioned before. So in San Luis Obispo County, 52% of households are rent burdened and 27% are severely cost burdened. What does that mean? So rent burden means that they're paying more than 30% of their income towards housing. And severely cost burden means that they're paying more than 50% of their income towards their housing. So at Peoples, just to contrast that 52% and 27%, our numbers are 21%. So 21% of our households are paying more than 30% of their income for their housing. And then only 4% are paying more than 50%. And that's usually more of a temporary situation for those households that, again, with the services that we provide, we try to actively address. So at Peoples, our at our senior properties, the average percentage of income for the seniors is 25% of their income. It goes towards rent, and for our family properties, it is 27%. So neighborhood, so along with conditions inside the home, conditions in the surrounding neighborhood are really having a powerful effect on health. Safety, access to amenities, employment opportunities, transportation, all those things are critical. At people's with new construction projects, we actually have to take all those things, proximity to all those things, into consideration. And so we really, we like to think that when we come to a neighborhood, we actually make that neighborhood better. So I wanted to talk a little bit now about some of the services that we provide for our residents, because providing housing is not all we do, and we really, again, we look at our housing as a building block to really having the opportunity to change and transform life. So we have a lot of services, and all these services are at no cost to our residents. So first and foremost, we have individualized clinical case management services through our supportive housing program that, again, is available to any resident at no cost. We have an after-school educational program for kids from kindergarten up through college, and those take the shape of 10 learning centers at our properties that are currently serving over 475 kids. We have health services throughout some of our properties through partnerships with NOR Clinic and Dignity Health. We have on-site food programs, 15 different programs currently, farmers markets, food bank, brown bag programs, community gardens, summer lunch in the park, and health-related educational events. We do on-site health fairs. We have exercise classes at just about every one of our properties. Zumba is incredibly popular, so I've never done it myself, but boy, a lot of people do it. So the other thing we do, and I talked about that community space at our properties, which is such a key thing for us, because we use that to leverage that asset that we have, that property and that space, to really create partnerships with community organizations. And so we're really proud that we've got over 75 community organizations that we partner with, from food banks to public health programs to local hospitals, clinics, school districts, and lots of other nonprofits. And that's really one of the things that we do that, again, really gives the opportunity to transform the lives of our residents, as well as providing a real resource for other organizations within the community. This is not cheap to do, but we view these services really as both essential and cost-effective investments in our communities. If you combine our education, our resident services, and our community building and engagement programs, the total budget for those is about $3 million dollars annually. So it's a significant investment. We do that in partnership with a lot of community foundations, a lot of individual donors, and then through the support of our properties. Our properties are really our biggest funder of those programs, and who are the chief funders of our properties? Really, our residents in the rents they pay, and so I think that's a really important thing to point out, that that really our residents are one of our biggest funders. So some challenges to healthy housing. So not enough housing is being built in California. That's not a news flash. But what perhaps is that typically when there's not enough of something, the sort of the folks at the lowest level bear the biggest brunt of that. And so the very low income really do bear the brunt of that. So currently there is about a 1 million unit shortage in affordable housing in California, and it's getting worse by about 100,000 units every year. So it's a problem despite all the efforts of a lot of really good folks out there, that is getting worse as and rapidly as time goes by. So there's not enough funding, public funding, for creating affordable housing, for social services, and for economic development. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that we're, you know, as a society, we're spending on these things, but we're just not spending in the most beneficial or cost-effective manner. And I will refer back to the comment I made about how many days of hospitalization or jail time you get for what it costs for a year of affordable housing. So some goals for us as we go forward, as we really want to continue to grow our supportive services for our residents. And so, again, we've got that sort of $3 million investment every year, and we want to see that grow. One of the things we want to do is really move to more outcome-based metrics for our resident service programs so that we can better measure and demonstrate the impact of our programs. Right now, we do a lot of measuring of sort of inputs, so number of collaborations and those kind of things, but we really need to start measuring the true impact of all those collaborations. So we're going to continue to develop beautiful, new, and safe affordable housing. We've got a lot of projects in the pipeline, but every affordable housing from sort of development from conception to the day the doors open is at least 5 years. So it takes a long time to build these. We're going to have, I think, three new projects opening up in the next year and probably every year thereafter. And again, that's in the three county area. So we want to continue to increase those collaborative relationships that we have with other community organizations to really leverage, again, the resources that we have. And one of the things I didn't mention that we want to continue to grow is our Resident Assistance Fund, which is really a terrific thing that we have that I haven't had at any other place I've worked. So it's really a fund that provides emergency assistance for families so that during crisis times they can remain housed. That is one of the reasons why we have almost a non-existent eviction rate. So really proud of that. So just close with a quote: healthy housing is a home where physical, mental, and socioeconomic environment supports household members in making healthy choices, achieving educational and economic success, and engaging in robust social and cultural networks. So thank you so much. Any questions?
Commissioner Campbell.
Always. I was struck by a statistic that families who rent move an average of every 20 months. That must be terribly disruptive for the kids. But a related question, what percent of housed families rent as opposed to own their own?
That is a good question. And it's really different in just about every community. So I think in SLO, it's like about 65% renters. And I'm not sure if that's the city of SLO or the county of SLO. Typically, in most communities outside of California anyway, there's a majority. It's probably like more like 60-40, 65-35 of owners versus renters. California, because the cost of ownership is so prohibitive, that's really flipped. And you're right, moving is highly detrimental to kids and every member of a family. And just think about it, a move usually often facilitates a new school, new set of friends. Again, losing that. I never really appreciated some of this until I moved out of state, away from all those family supports and the friend supports that I had built for 25 years in Seattle, and had to begin rebuilding those things. And I'm a person who has a lot more resources than somebody who's lower income. So. Thank you.
Susan?
Thank you for your presentation. I had a question for you.
Oh, for me?
Yeah.
You're on the hot spot, right, Joe? So don't go away.
Since you come from Seattle, one of the things that on the housing committee, that we've seen a lot of innovative projects coming out of Seattle. And from the tiny homes, we've had some speakers come in for that. I was just at our tiny home program day out here at the Madonna, and there was a provider there from Seattle that had innovative little units that they were putting up in various places. What's the difference between why they can do them there and we're not able to do them in California? And I will say, I also had a project newsletter that I get from the California Healthcare Foundation, and today I just got it and was looking at that Oakland is now putting some small units around their community on city property, and even some of the Caltrans properties that are housing people at that full need that can't get into a shelter or don't have a shelter, but they're providing that. What are your thoughts about what we could do here? We'll be solution oriented.
Yeah. So that is a great question. And I really think that I went to that tiny home expo too, and it was a great thing, because you got to see sort of the range of what a tiny home means to different folks and what it can be. And I think for a lot of folks, homeless in particular, it is a it is a real viable option for housing, whether that is permanent housing or kind of long-term transitional housing. It is an option. There are folks in the SLO community who are working on that, and Peoples is hoping to partner with those folks. So there is good work happening out there. I really think I think a big part of it is, honestly, I mean, in Seattle, I do know it was a long, hard fight where the city government was opposed to it for a long, long time, and only recently has become more open to it. And I think, honestly, that's frankly because the there's been an explosion of homeless in Seattle, and it's kind of ironic as the town has become that much more affluent, just like San Francisco and a lot of these large areas. And so I think, unfortunately, that made the city government a little bit more open to it. Hopefully, in SLO, we don't have to get to that. I think right now in SLO, the community is open to the concept of tiny homes, but I think it's maybe not as open to that concept for as a solution to homelessness, as a solution to affordability. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I really think in Seattle, like low-income housing institute is one of the big drivers in that, and I do know Sharon Lee, who's the executive director there, has been working on this concept for at least the last 10 years, and so it just took a lot of effort and sort of a change in sort of the willingness of the city government, and so but a lot of extraordinary effort on a lot of people's parts up there.
Thank you, and I hope your connections there will help us down here.
Yeah.
Hi, Joe. I have a question as well for you. Actually, I wanted to give Stephanie a chance to answer any of that question. On Tiny Home, she is the chair of the Healthy Communities Work Group and is quite a local expert on
I think at
tiny
the end
homes.
Of our presentation, we'll invite public comment. So, no, just
Perfect.
Right there, Stephanie. We do want to hear from you. So, okay.
So my question for Joe is actually, I know that People Self-Up Housing works in three counties. I'm curious about any unique challenges that you've identified specifically to building and supporting healthy housing in Slo County as opposed to the other two counties?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So I should say also that I am I'm the chief operating officer, so my primary focus is once they get built. That's where they kind of get thrown over to me to make sure that they stay operating well. So as far as that development process, there's probably other folks who could answer that better. So you know, in this area, I think one of the things that struck me is how really most communities are pretty open to affordable housing here. I think one of the common challenges with all the communities and across all three of those counties is the scale of the housing. Folks are really... While most communities are open to it, they do not want large projects, and so it is really difficult from an operating standpoint to make smaller projects work, and so that is probably one of the biggest challenges here. Water is a huge challenge in Slo County, probably in particular for us, but I guess to answer your question, I don't think there's anything unique about Slo County as compared to the other counties. So
thanks, Joe.
Does anybody else have questions for Joe while he's up here? All right, let's let Carolyn do her presentation, and then we'll invite Stephanie up.
Great. Well, good evening, and thank you for having me here. So I'm Carolyn Berg, and like Joe, since most of you are new faces to me, I thought I'd take a moment to introduce myself and my background. So I've been working for the county for the last 13 years. Most of that time has been spent as an engineer in the Public Works Department and working on our long-term water resources planning and management activities. So pretty in line with what Joe's talking about, trying to overcome some of those big constraints in our region here. And then most recently, I've been brought over to our county's administrative office to now lead this effort to oversee the development of a regional infrastructure and housing strategic plan. And so that's what I'm going to go through with you today. I've kept it pretty brief since we are just in the earlier stages of the project, but I'd welcome any questions, and I'll do my best to answer them as we go forward. So why act now, and why are we talking about acting regionally? And I think you've already heard several notes of this just with Joe and Grace's presentations. But, you know, anecdotally, of course, I think we've all felt it, that there is a critical shortage of affordable housing in the area. We see articles nationwide throughout the state just about the lack of housing that our local workforce and community members can afford. But on top of that, we also have state law that's requiring that local agencies should be planning for housing. And what we've seen in the past is that the state hands down allocations based on population projections they think that our region will see in coming years. And they ask local cities and counties to plan for how we would accommodate those housing units and the population growth over time. And what we've seen in the past is that while perhaps it's been possible for us to plan for those through our local housing elements and land use plans, we haven't actually seen our communities be able to produce those housing units, especially when it comes to the very low and low income affordability brackets. And if any of you saw the grand jury report that came out earlier this summer, you know, they really highlighted the percentages and the challenges that most of our cities have seen over the last 5-year cycle, really, with the housing plans. So that's one challenge. And then, as Joe mentioned, you know, as you talk about housing, you can't talk about housing without talking about what infrastructure and resources are needed to support that. And so in some communities, they're already constrained just to meet their own current population. And I think we felt that in the recent drought as communities ran low on their supplies. We didn't really have a lot of places to turn because we're isolated from most other parts of the state. And then other cities like City of San Luis Obispo that have a more diverse, say, water supply portfolio, they do pretty well through some of those harder times, but as they look out towards population growth and build out, then it starts to get more challenging. And like I said, because we're an isolated region, it's challenging to think how any one single community would be able to accomplish the solutions that we need. And so that's where it starts to drive this conversation of regionalism. Because the challenges around housing supply and because the challenges around infrastructure are so large and take a lot of finances and resources to support them, we really have to start thinking beyond any one agency and beyond any one community to solve those issues. And so the time's kind of ripe for this conversation. Statewide, I think we've seen with our new governor that he has a huge focus on affordability and on access to housing in our state. And we saw that through his recent budget process and his approval of $1.75 billion towards housing and related services. We've also seen that through him implementing a number of legislative actions that kind of up the enforcement actions the state's able to take and up the enforcement compliance fines that could be put on local agencies that don't plan for this housing stock. So he's doing a little bit of the carrot and stick, trying to find ways to incentivize agencies to plan for the growth needed, but also find ways to enforce against agencies and communities that aren't willing to plan for and perhaps produce housing. And there's a lot of funding opportunities, like I mentioned, in this recent budget. So right now, all of the cities in the county are pursuing about $1.4 million of planning grant funds to help look into some of the possible strategies we might pursue moving forward. And one of those things is to help offset the costs of the regional plan I'm working on. And so earlier this year, the County Board of Supervisors took action to dedicate resources and time towards leading an effort to work with all the seven cities, the Council of Government, and some of our key development stakeholders, including People Self-Help and Haslo and our Home Builders Association, Chambers, and others. And the idea is that we'll develop a strategic action plan over the year 2019 through 2020, and it would integrate the efforts of each of the cities in the county in looking at the housing needs and how we'll plan for those, and then identifying and prioritizing the most critical infrastructure needs to support that. And then laying out an implementation path. So how do we start addressing those most critical priorities first? And the idea is to chip away at solving some of these bigger challenges with housing and infrastructure. I'll get into the details of these, but in general, we're talking about three main actions over the coming, basically year and a half from now. The first component is I'm embarking on an effort with our partner agencies that's never been done before. And so a big component of this is going to be building trust and building relationships between all of the agencies, trying to find how we work well together and how to leverage our strengths of our communities be effective moving forward. And then the next goal is to actually develop the action plan. So I'll go through that in a moment. And then to align our land use planning documents. And what I really mean on that one is align our housing elements that the eight agencies are in the midst of producing right now. And given that we're supposed to be, by state law, updating and turning in our housing elements by the end of next year, I'm also trying to track to that same timeline. So trying to have our strategic action plan complete on or around the same deadline of December 2020. So a little bit on the work plan for the strategic action plan. So I'm in the midst of working on this with all of our city partners. And the first step is just defining the vision. So looking at all of the plans that already exist, there's plenty of information out there on projecting our community's future population and housing stock anticipated. But my plan is going to focus on what are the goals around that? What are we trying to achieve between now and 2040? And what does our region look like in that future? And then from there, where are our priority development areas? So it's not realistic that we would build all over the county. You know, there's policies in place to try to focus housing on or more urban areas and try to put housing close to jobs. And the idea there is to really is more on the side of looking at people's livability. So if you work in San Luis Obispo, can there be options for housing so that you're not commuting as far and thereby also reducing the impacts on infrastructure? And so that's that second tier there is defining priority development areas. So trying to figure out if we can focus in on just certain parts of the county first, and maybe we can focus our resources and time on those areas. Then the next step has been developing our inventory of infrastructure needs. So talking with the cities and the county to understand what transportation needs, water needs, and wastewater needs are there in order to see this future growth of housing, or what's stopping us now, essentially, from getting that housing in place. Obviously, there's way more need than there is funding and resources. So the next step I'll have to work on with the cities is what's a fair way to prioritize among the many needs. And that way we can focus in the near term on maybe just a few priorities and hopefully unlocking the potential for some of these affordable housing projects Joe had mentioned. You know, if we can start chipping away at the infrastructure needs, that theoretically could start to allow communities to build out in the way that they envision. I'm also working with my team on coming up with an inventory of funding that's available and trying to figure out implementation strategies that might be accessible for our area. So examples there, like in July, our county board approved us looking into the feasibility of pursuing a housing bond on the next November ballot. So we're just looking at polling and understanding whether or not the community would support something like that. But the idea would be that perhaps that could serve as a long-term funding strategy and help subsidize some of the housing or facilities needs. Other options we've seen in other parts of the country would be using, and here locally, it would be using public lands as a way of creating or reducing the cost of a housing development by taking away the cost of the land and using kind of a long-term lease structure. So we're looking at strategies like that and also how we could best take our small rural county and make us competitive for some of these state and federal funding programs that exist. and all of that will get buttoned up nice and neatly into a strategic action plan. And like I said, the aim is December 2020. It's a pretty lofty goal, but I'm very hopeful that we'll make some good progress in the next year. And then the next part I thought I'd highlight just because I think it's really relevant. So the last item I'd mention was lining up our land use planning documents to serve the strategic action plan. And so all of the eight agencies are in the midst of developing their housing elements, which basically serve as the Bible of their housing. So talking about what are their parcels and land use right now and how does that lend itself towards the next 10 years of housing the state says we need to plan for. Historically in the past, all the agencies go off and plan those on their own and work with the state on their own to get them approved. We're doing something a little different this time just to try to create that collaboration. And so I've been working with all of the staffs of the city and county, and we meet on about a monthly basis to talk about our approach to developing the housing element, to share lessons learned that we've seen throughout the country or perhaps that one local city has tried implementing. And we've been talking about how could that potentially be explored in the other local agencies here. We've started with a giant list of possible policies and strategies, and now I'm working with the staff to start honing in on what are some of the most important regional policies we might be able to pursue. And we're also trying to come up with a summary of what's already been done. I think that's important for our communities to know is how far we've come, to create that optimism of this is a challenge we've continued to overcome in the past, but and trying to help ourselves see what we've done so far and then how that lends itself to help in the future. And all of that will get summarized into a regional section, and I'll include that in the strategic action plan. But also something I'm hoping we'll do is have all of the eight housing elements include this regional section. And so again, it's just starting to change the story and really make it clear to our communities that our housing really does touch residents from community to community. Even if I live in the boundaries of the city of San Luis Obispo, I'm still impacted by the needs of city of Paso and otherwise. So that's another big effort, and we've seen a lot of good progress so far and are really looking forward to seeing that move forward over the coming months. And then after we've worked through all of those tasks, the idea would be, like I said, to put that into a really concise strategic action plan and then jump into 2021 to actually start moving on some of the actions we've defined in the plan. So the plan's just to give us a unified framework that we can then start acting on. And I think the important thing over the coming year will be really working between the agencies and our stakeholders to get creative and to kind of push outside of our comfort zone a little bit to find how we might start making progress on meeting some of these needs. And so this last page, I just started our project website, but over time we'll be filling this in. It links to all the housing elements of the cities and the county, and over time we'll be putting more data on there and information to help support our communities in understanding their housing stock in the area. And with that, I'd welcome any questions you might have.
Good. Thank you. Questions for Carolyn? Susan? Go ahead. Okay.
I just, thank you. I'm going to forward you this, the California healthcare piece that came in today that's got a pretty very interesting report. I didn't go through it in detail today, but it brought up about those different kinds of housing pieces that they've been innovative with up in Oakland. And I'll forward that report to you because I think you'll find it helpful.
Yeah, I'd really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think that was it at this point. The other thing I wanted to bring up, you know, the some of these other things. I'm a native of Cambria. I grew up there, but I work in Atascadero. And what I see, is lots of cars full of lots of people going to work over there in the restaurants and the motels because they can't afford, there's so little housing over there for anybody. And so why have we not yet gotten buses that can go from Paso or Atascadero over to Cambria to service the employees that are over there?
I couldn't answer why it hasn't happened. I'm going to guess resources. But that's certainly something we're talking about with the local council of governments and the regional transportation authority. You know, I think as we make progress on defining the priority development areas and, you know, really digging into the jobs housing, I think focusing on the transit and other opportunities to support moving people from their house to their workplace will be beneficial. And I don't know specifically with Cambria, but in general, I think that's something we've been talking about and we'll continue to do so.
Well, and it's not just that either. It's a lot of times it's the services for some of the people in Cambria. Then they've got to travel to Atascadero or Paso or San Luis. And especially if they're coming on into the North County, which many of them prefer to do, it's just impossible. You've got to take all these buses and then come to San Luis and then turn around and loop back to the North County and take the same thing back to get home. Mm-hmm. And I just think there's some better shortcuts.
I hear you. Yeah, sure.
Anybody else have questions for Carolyn?
Did Penny?
Dr. Bornstein.
Well, so hi, Carolyn. Thank you. And yeah. To Joe, and unfortunately Grace isn't here, but I wanted to throw out the $64 million question that I started to address in an email diatribe to those who were putting this wonderful program together. And just curious as to how different folks who are involved in the solutions to housing and homelessness in our community would answer, which is, how do we find the sweet spot between addressing the nexus between those issues of homelessness that have broader issues that come to bear on homelessness, such as mental health or substance use and domestic violence and lots of things, and affordable housing, which may for many not have any of those issues. And it seems to me in our wealth of riches in some ways related to our nonprofits or even our governmental sector in trying to address these that we sometimes both trip over ourselves in terms of taking on the you know, putting everything into one basket, and then sometimes maybe don't do as effective a job of scaffolding the issues. And there's a question in here somewhere, but it's basically how do you see, at least for the two organizations that are here, and I know we've got representative from HSOC, and finding the how to be effective in both the synergy of these issues as well as the distinct approaches to these different issues, I guess is the $64 million question.
You can pick who goes first to answer.
Well, for me, I know that there's a lot of discussions on the county side around homeless and homeless services. And I think there's a very natural nexus when we talk about housing and I think that fits very well into the conversation on homelessness. And I've been talking a lot with our social services staff about how do we think a little more strategically when we're looking at all the different funding sources and things like that, to really understand, you know, how much of our state or federal funding are we putting towards homeless services or housing to try to make sure that we're creating more need. I don't think that's really answering your question, but it's something I'm keenly aware of and trying to figure out how they fit. They definitely fit together, but how we actually work on the efforts of prioritizing is something we're in the midst of talking about among the staffs of the departments right now. Yeah, and I would say on top of that, just creating the housing that is affordable to our low and very low income levels will be especially important, and trying to find ways to subsidize, you know, that.
So I don't mean to interrupt, Joe. You'll get your turn. But to that, how did you decide who your partners were going to be when you come together to develop this strategic plan?
I started off with the cities because they're the ones developing the housing elements along with the county. So my first question had to be to those that have defined the build-out of communities, and then working with their public works departments and community development so they can tell me, you know, what's stopping them. A lot of times, like for the county's general plan and housing elements, a lot of communities, there'll be discussions of zoning changes that could happen and how housing could happen, but it's often underpinned by a constraint of lack of water, that sort of thing. So I've started with them as partners, but I certainly am working with our housing coalition too, which is made up of 8 agencies, including nonprofit developers and for-profit. And then next year, I think there'll be a much broader push outward.
Okay. It would seem to me, yeah, that you'd have to broaden that to bring all of the players into it.
Okay, sure. Sorry, Jill. Mm-hmm. Your turn.
So I, too, am not sure exactly how to answer that question, but I will offer a few thoughts. So I would say one of the things, and is particularly as it relates to housing, homeless folks, is there just is not a, these are observations on my part, I don't think there's a great deal of variety in the types of housing that are provided in this county and a lot of counties, and I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges. There is not a lot of service enriched housing in the truest sense for chronically homeless populations, and the services, as I think just about every one of us said tonight, are absolutely essential. I'm a big believer in housing first models, because it's really hard to know what a person's really sort of their baseline behaviors are when they're homeless and every aspect of their life is under stress. That's just going to exacerbate every challenge that person has. If they have a mental health issue, it's going to be worse when they're homeless. If they have a substance abuse issue, it's going to be worse when they're homeless. So I think trying to address those needs, sometimes we try to fix everything and then provide them housing as the last step, and I think rather it needs to probably be the first step in conjunction with those support services. But so I think that, I don't know if that's answering your question, but I think that's a big part of it, is there's providing a variety of housing types, but also recognizing that we're going to have to take some chances on people, provide that housing first, and with the not just the faith, but with the with proven facts that their life is going to get better just because they've got that housing. So.
Other questions?
Yes.
Catherine?
Carolyn, hi.
Hi.
I also read the most recent grand jury report on this, and I'm trying to remember if this was included in the report, but is it not a policy that's been established that developers or builders, if they're going to be building a multi-unit, they have to have some kind of a low-income housing project to go along with that? And if they decide they don't want to do that, they can opt out, and it's supposed to go into a fund. Do you know about that?
Yeah, so there's a inclusionary housing, is what it's often called, and in lieu fees. So not all of our local agencies have adopted something like that, but the county and several cities have adopted that sort of an ordinance. So for the county, I think it's for any permitted housing that's over 2,200 square feet, even if it's a single home, then certain fees are collected and they're put into a collective like funding pot, essentially. And then once a year, the county board looks at how to then distribute that. And they look across all unincorporated and incorporated areas for the best project that comes forward and meets the priorities of affordable housing. But there's also the option that a developer could include within their development a certain a minimum number of units of affordable housing.
Okay. And do you know what the health of that fund is? How...
I don't know
how much money are we talking.
Yeah, I don't know what it's at right now. Honestly, the County Planning and Building Department did just go to the board with a large suite of funding sources that are available. I don't know if you happen to know, since you guys have put projects in, but they only just changed the ordinance earlier this year to start including all single-family residents over 2,200 square feet. So I know that that's anticipated to generate quite a bit more. So we'll see. I think next year we'll start to get more of a track record of how that's collected.
Thank you.
So maybe we can find that amount, and then one of the updates for our upcoming meeting we'll see it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And I will say that even though I don't know the amount, I will say that when communities require in lieu fees and inclusionary housing, it is often the difference between something affordable housing not happening in a community or happening. And we're fortunate in that a couple of the larger developments that are happening in town, so like Rigetti Ranch is one where we've actually are able to develop affordable housing in those because of in that inclusionary housing ordinance that City of SLO has. So
good, thank you both.
I'm sorry Susan, go
ahead.
Yeah, I have another question on that. I think that's something to put in your plan for 2020, is having the cities and the county have some accounting on those in lieu funds, because I've had a little experience with that 10 years ago, and you know, through the city that we worked with, and they were surprised at how much money they found that was in lieu funds, but somebody inside had to go searching. And so we've wondered about that, you know, especially with the developers may want to know where their money's going, and is it going to inclusionary housing or not. And so there doesn't seem to be much record keeping. It kind of, I think, gets slushed into the general fund and used when somebody's got a project. But I don't know that anybody's keeping track of that and making sure that it's in a fund for the in lieu fees and that people know how much it is.
I could speak to that really quickly. That's something I've actually asked our county team to pull together. So they're looking back as far as our records go, and we have a huge list of the projects that have been funded using federal HUD funding or the county's Title 29 in lieu fee program. Or otherwise. And yeah, to your point, I think it's really important to show people what has been funded by the communities and then continue to build that trajectory moving forward. But it has to be used for that specific purpose. It can't just fall into the general fund. But I agree on wanting to make sure it's available and transparent somewhere on what that's done.
Thank you both. Okay. And now I'll invite public comment about our presentations this evening. And Stephanie, I can't see. Oh, you are still there. Good. Would you want to step up and share a little bit about the tiny house project or
wonderful
exposition
you.
That you did?
Yes. So many wonderful things have been talked about here this evening. I'm so glad I came. as the chair of the Healthy Communities Working Group for these past 2 years, this idea of housing as a social determinant of health has been on our radar, and we're very glad the amount of attention that's being shown on it. And then in my other work as an outreach director for Smart Share Housing Solutions, a lot of these same topics come up all the time, but in a little bit more of a personal way, because we're meeting with people around the county who are in housing need. And so housing insecurity is something that we see directly people's health being affected by the stress of not having stable, secure housing. While they're not oftentimes homeless, but occasionally they are, we'll have a person come to us who still qualifies for our programs. We run the home sharing program here in the county. So we have been successful in helping even somebody through the VASH program, a homeless veteran, find a home share program. But what we see, and which we just now have talked about, is the need for options, for housing options, because everyone is kind of coming to this from a different place. And while home sharing serves a certain percentage of the population and serves it really beautifully, maybe a vulnerable single senior person who's in the house all by themselves with extra rooms and could really benefit from some another person in the house, maybe paying them some rent or being just another person for security reasons for someone who's vulnerable. The seekers, the people on the side that are looking, are maybe looking for a little bit more privacy when they're looking for affordable housing. And so a tiny house really speaks to that. And so Smart Share Housing Solutions now has two programs, the Home Share Slow Program, but now also Tiny House Consulting. And so we put on the expo here in the county to help people expand their ideas of what housing could look like and what housing options are. We have a real, and this was mentioned this evening as well, a growing number of single person households in our city here in San Luis and in our county. So when San Luis passed an ordinance that allowed for tiny houses on wheels in backyards, we were thrilled because we think that really can serve individual people who could live in the neighborhoods and find much more affordable housing than they could, because we just don't have a lot of housing stock for one person, studio apartments or one bedroom apartments. And while we need housing all across the board and building housing even, we see that a lot more three, four bedroom houses are built in our county across all the cities, and not as many one bedroom single units for a single person. So we're excited about tiny houses for the potential, mostly in the county unincorporated spaces in a lot of our cities, and we're just thrilled that San Luis has an ordinance where other cities can look at that and maybe make similar ordinances to help people in affordable housing. So I'm grateful to have heard and learned so much today here, and to have the opportunity to share a little bit about what we're doing at Smart Share as well.
Thank you for sharing. Anybody have any questions for Stephanie?
Yeah, okay. I had one other comment. When we're talking about a variety of housing, I think we have an issue in this county that we think of sober living as a criminal justice. We've attached it only to criminal justice. And, you know, people that are punished by going into sober living. And that's not the way it is in the rest of the country or the state. And it's congregate housing for people who are supporting each other in entering that journey of sobriety. And it's real important, especially in that first year. And it can be anybody, you know. And but in this county, we have extremely limited, and it's all built right into the criminal justice system, that they're coming out of jail or they're coming out of the prisons. And, you know, I think that's another opportunity that we need to look at, is to have more of that available. I firmly believe in 50 now, but there may be somebody in there that's trying to stay sober that would do better in a sober living environment rather than in a congregate house where other people there can use, or someone that's already been detoxed at the hospital or in one of the medically fragile programs, and they're going to need that special type of housing. So I think that we all need to add that to the mix and understand that it's not just a criminal justice opportunity program.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to folks in the housing world, supportive housing with capital S, capital H could be a very specific thing, but I think really supportive housing in all different forms, people supporting each other through housing is very important. We're very interested in co-living. We have a lot of people interested in having, being in a living situation where they have maybe their own room, but they're having community around cooking and a kitchen and community space, and so having the opportunity to find an underutilized hotel or a very large house and to help people live together communally in those kinds of spaces would be yet another housing option that we're very interested in as well.
Good. And you mentioned 50 now. I think it's 70 now. Otima has increased the number by 20 already. So it's nice to see that program successful, and they have housed a number of people. Thank you, Stephanie. All right. Thank you all for being here with us this evening. We'll look forward to hearing from you again soon to hear the progress that you're making and what's going on with you. Let us turn to Dr. Bornstein and have our public health report.
Great. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. So I did want to, I hope it's okay, we're on the cusp of the next board meeting, not the one that's tomorrow, but the one that comes after that in early December, of actually bringing forward some policy ordinance action at the unincorporated area related to smoking. And I haven't really put that out publicly yet, but I think we're close enough for the public seeing an agenda item that's coming in a few weeks, actually a couple of agenda items related to the board and the public's consideration of action that we might take in the unincorporated area. So I wanted us, build upon what you were saying about other communities in our county and across the state and across the nation are taking action, particularly in the vaping area. But secondhand smoke continues to be an issue. And now that we've got cannabis potentially in public areas and we've got vaping as another form of delivery of inhalation products, we are looking at two areas of consideration. One related to expanding the area for to other public areas for no smoking in the unincorporated areas that would encapsulate as well vaping and cannabis use. And then secondly, looking at restrictions to the local retail sale in unincorporated areas for vaping products. So stay tuned. That will be coming before our board. And the way, because it is ordinance that we're looking at, will be introduced probably on consent in early December and then come back for dialogue and public input, et cetera, in the first meeting in January. But I've been painfully sort of quiet on an area that is of great interest and concern to me in light of the ongoing epidemic that is going on related to the health consequences of vaping in particular. Youth uptake doesn't seem to be decreasing in light of that. And so I'm just happy to be able to say that we have been working behind the scenes and now we're getting ready to go public.
Good. That's good to hear.
Thanks. I did want to also say that we, Health Department-wide, we started today a large effort to do a performance measurement training for all of our staff. So those of us who have come out of public health school are very familiar with this language, but we and many of our program areas have performance measures, but we're undertaking a concerted effort in concert with all the other kind of big picture efforts that we've been taking in the area, undertaking in the areas of health assessment and health improvement and departmental strategic planning. And this is kind of the last pillar, if you will, of bringing all of these together is department-wide performance measurement, not only for ourselves, but when we complete this process, it will be an additional avenue for public scrutiny and transparency of what it is that we not only do, but how we measure what we do and how we're doing.
in terms of delivery of services. So that's been an exciting thing that's just starting to emerge this week. And then all of a sudden, there has been a slew of grant opportunities made available to the Public Health Department, as well as the health agency. The first one on my list is actually a joint effort between the Behavioral Health Department and the Public Health Department. So whole person counts, whole person care it was started 4 years ago as a Medi-Cal waiver that counties could apply for federal and state funding to do projects related to the integration of healthcare delivery, particularly for vulnerable populations in terms of low income, homeless, substance using, mental health affected individuals. And now, as part of the state's budget this past year, that state only funding is being offered to the other counties who were not able to take advantage of the larger whole person care opportunity. So our county does anticipate applying for a grant to implement a whole person care project. And what we are looking to do with that money, it turns out when you say, you know, almost $1 million or $827,000 when it's divided by 5 years and you take into account benefits for employees and et cetera, it really doesn't go very far. But we are looking to serve as kind of a centralized hub for healthcare navigation across the systems of care in our county, and to have this serve as an additional piece to those agencies that are already doing much of the case management work, like you heard from Grace, you know, recuperative care and hospital readmissions avoidance, helping people stay out of the system of jail and psychiatric health facility and such. So with TEMA and behavioral health and CHC and all these organizations, but to have kind of a centralized hub for all these spokes, and that's what we're looking to do with that. We have the opportunity to apply for what is going to be a very competitive grant process. I know this will be music to some of your ears, but before you get too excited, there are only six applicants that will be accepted for new Alzheimer's money. The reason I looked at Commissioner Raymond, and she's not the only one. I frequently get questions about, and what's public health doing about the seniors in our community? And I know this commission at large has talked about, you know, the aging tsunami, et cetera. We're going to give it our best shot, but again, there's only six counties across the state who are going to be awarded, but hopefully we'll know that in a few months. Out of the blue, we got the opportunity.
Would it help us because we have so many seniors in our county, Pam?
That was what I thought, and now I've looked at the details of the application, and there's all these risk factors associated with it, and so our ranking on some areas still doesn't. I thought, okay, now this is one that we can actually compete for compared to many state grants, and doesn't look quite as rosy as I initially thought, based just simply on our age pyramid, but we'll see. And two other smaller grants that just sort of dropped in our lap in this last couple of weeks. One is Title 10, which is the federal block grant for family planning services. They're giving us the opportunity to expand on quality measurement of the services that we're providing, and so we're going to try to get a little bit of funding out of that. And then the last thing is our laboratory applied for a small grant to bring up Legionella testing, which is a good thing because we have seen a couple of interesting cases in the past year, and we actually had to deal with out-of-county laboratories and figuring out what was going on in terms of the results. So if we can bring that in-house, that will be a great addition. And that is my report. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Bornstein? Okay. Let's do our own commissioner updates then. Bob, can we start down at your end? And by the way, congratulations on your new title. Tell us what you've been appointed to.
It's not exactly a title. Starting in January, I'll be an alternate medical member of the APCD hearing board. So in practical terms, I think that means I'll be sitting in the back at every time they convene. I'll be very well informed and can bring back hopefully useful information here. Currently, this morning, the hearing board met to consider an effort to try to move the whole process along. The history behind that is that the state parks has to submit an annual work plan that's very, very detailed every year. That plan has to be submitted in a timely fashion to the scientific advisory group, and the air pollution control officer, if they have objections, and they usually do, they send it back to state parks. And there's this rather circular iterative process that's built into the plan. Unfortunately, it's not working very well. And primarily, it appears that state parks, for whatever reason, maybe resources, is chronically late in getting their plans submitted. Often late enough that the scientific advisory group is unable to look it over and critique it, and their part is really critical. So the APCD board as a whole has gotten kind of frustrated and called this hearing board meeting this morning. At this meeting, a plan that was agreed upon by both state parks and APCD was submitted with very rigid deadlines for submitting plans, for making sure that they were reviewed properly by the scientific advisory group. There was a lot of push to finally stop this process of let's give them another 6 months and another 6 months. But that went nowhere. And anyway, this more rigid, compressed plan was accepted. And we're kind of back in it again. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence of an end game here is what I find a little frustrating. Anyway, I'll be able to keep you. I'll be able to share my frustrations with you over the next couple of years, probably.
Well, thank you for going. Susan?
No report.
Okay. Amy? You attended the Healthy Communities meeting on my behalf, so I will let you report out on that.
Okay, I will do that.
I attended two meetings. First, the Adult Services Policy Council meeting. There was a speaker. The director from the county libraries gave a great presentation. They're really expanding some of their services. And if you have any questions, Chris Barnickel was the speaker, and he can actually speak to any group that is interested in asking questions. One thing for me, being very interested in the seniors, they actually have a contact person looking at some of the senior issues and ways of getting information as well as books and literary type things out to people who are homebound, which is kind of nice. There was also someone from counseling, and so that was interesting. And then I attended the next meeting, which was the San Luis Obispo Commission on Aging. And the census 2020, everybody counts. We actually are number 5, and there's 10 regions in California. And the presenter, Patricia Vasquez, Topete, T-O-P-E-T-E. She gave a great presentation on how they're going to be counting. We're going to be counted. It's going to be online, but for those hard-to-reach populations, they have a plan in place. So if you don't get a postcard, you don't get counted. They'll be out there looking and finding ways to make sure that we have an accurate account. She also will speak to any group that is interested. And then how Housing 2020, we're looking at Matt Leo. He's one of the planners, and he gave an update on here in our county what we're doing 1 year and 5 years. And, you know, beyond what they talked about tonight, he also brought up the fact that they are also looking at stabilizing neighborhoods so that we have not just looking at what we're going to build, but what we have and to stabilize that. So that's it.
Thank you. Ginger?
I don't have a report.
Okay. Catherine?
No report.
Candace?
The Naloxone Action Team met on November 8th. We had updates from the jail program, from the syringe exchange, from drug and alcohol services, and behavioral health about what's going on with naloxone distribution and overdose prevention education. And we spent some time brainstorming because the county just recently released numbers around fentanyl overdoses that you might have seen in the news. So since May, 10 people have been confirmed to have died from lethal fentanyl. We've known that this was coming for a while. It's a statewide problem. It's a countrywide problem. And so we talked about how to reach more folks with overdose prevention education and naloxone, particularly those that are most at risk in the county, but also friends and family members of those. So I think it's actually probably time for the Naloxone Action Team to come and give a little update, maybe together with the medication-assisted treatment team. So we'll see.
It's a good idea. It's been a couple of years since they've been here, I think.
Okay. I don't know.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll put you in charge of that program. So first of all, Commissioner Campbell didn't say anything about the Tobacco Coalition meeting that he and I attended last week, but we have two communities that are actively looking at updating or putting in a smoking ordinance. The city of Morro Bay has had the first reading on a very comprehensive ordinance. It may be one of the most comprehensive in our state, actually. And we did acknowledge that Commissioner Campbell was very instrumental in helping us get into that city to provide some education and what have you. So thank you for that. And then you all know as a result of those, we did the letters that we approved tonight. The other meeting that I went to, Commissioner Kleinman, who's our world traveler right now, was out of town at the time of the Healthy Communities work group, and so she asked me to go, which I was happy to do for her. They had a great meeting. We should have kept Stephanie here just a little longer to talk a bit more about it. Their primary presentation was a young man from Caltrans who came and talked about this comprehensive strategic plan that they're making for Highway 101 in what they consider South County, which is actually Santa Margarita through down to Santa Maria. He was extremely thankful that our public health, our Slow Health Counts website, had some good data that he was able to access, and he didn't have to reinvent the wheel. So he's taking that into account as they're looking at all along that corridor, what do they do, tying health into it. And he was very open to comments from the group, too, as well. Additionally, we reviewed and sent a letter of support for an infill project in Napomo, which is 12 single-family, two-story, two-garage units, and three apartment buildings that will consist of 24 one-bedroom apartments, two stories. There doesn't happen to be an elevator in there. So we were in the letter of support, we were suggesting that perhaps the first floor apartments could be maintained for disadvantaged people and seniors and that, but it's a nice infill project. And then we reviewed and commented on a 15-lot subdivision in Templeton. There is, to answer the question about affordable housing this evening, there is one lot set aside for affordable housing. We made a few other comments about restructuring the cul-de-sac to be a through street, and then the need to allow some space for daycare because it's likely to be an area where young families will be. The only other thing I have is just a little housekeeping item. Just remind all of this when we get the email from Mike that the meeting is going to be. I know we've all been doing a good job, but make sure you respond to him if you would so that he knows. He makes these wonderful packets for us, and that's how he knows how many to make, is if we tell him that we are going to be here or we are not going to be here. So thank you for all of you for doing that. Our flyer went out again this month to our email list. So again, if you have groups that you want to be put on that list to know about our meetings, please do so. With that, our standing committees, legislation, anything to report?
Yes. Okay. With us wrapping up 2019 and going into 2020, I thought I would touch upon some interesting legislation around healthcare bills that have been signed, mostly going into effect January 1st, 2020, which is just around the corner. The first of note is an Assembly Bill 824, which gives state attorney general power to go after pharmaceutical companies that are engaging in pay for delay, which is a practice where makers of brand name drugs can pay off generic manufacturers to keep lower cost generic versions off the market. So hopefully to see some more oversight in that come the new year. A second piece of legislation I wanted to mention was a newly adopted legislation as part of a state budget that will require Californians to have health insurance next year or face a penalty specific to California and the marketplace in covered California. Another interesting piece is California will be the first state to allow people to access HIV prevention drugs from pharmacies without a doctor's prescription. That is coming out of Senate Bill 159, which prohibits insurance companies from requiring patients to obtain prior authorization before getting that medication. First state to do that, which will be interesting to see how that looks in the coming year. And a couple other ones as well. One on the maternal health front. I think we all understand a little bit about social determinants of health and how it's impacting some of our maternal health policies. Senate Bill 464 will now be requiring perinatal health care providers to undergo bias training because they're acknowledging a 3 to 4 times more likelihood to die during childbirth for African-American women. The disproportionate effect of the maternal mortality rate on this community is a public health crisis, and this bill will start to have some implicit and bias training come the new year. Senate Bill 142 is addressing safer and better breastfeeding practices at work. It will require employers to provide new mothers with a private space that they did not provide before. And finally, I'd like to mention something on financial abuse for older adults. Investment advisors and broker-dealers will be required to report suspected financial abuse of elders or dependent adults under Senate Bill 496, with a growing Alzheimer's and dementia concerns in the state. And to note about smoking in public parks, Californians will be prohibited from smoking or vaping at state beaches and parks under Senate Bill 164, which will be passed, and with the exception of paved roads and parking areas.
Good job. Thank you. Well, Budget Committee, I'm sure, has nothing to report. How about nominating? So I was going to announce at the beginning of the meeting, and I forgot. Commissioner Moylan has resigned. She's taken a new job which means she isn't in San Luis Obispo during the week. So she's unable to attend the meeting. So we do have an opening in the commission seats now for a direct provider. So we need to probably start the recruitment process and get that filled. And we'll look to you, Jean, to do that. Okay. All right. Upcoming, go ahead.
Do we have to get an okay to put it to advertise for that?
Do we need to get an okay to ever? We could go ahead and start recruiting, can we? Right? Okay. Thank you. Can you go ahead and get that started, Mike? Initiate it? Okay. Thank you. Upcoming agenda items. Just a reminder, next month is our semi-annual planning meeting. We won't be here in the Board of Supervisors chambers. We'll be meeting in the large conference room at Public Health. Is it okay if we start at 6 o'clock like we usually do? Okay. We'll be planning for at least the next 6 months. So bring your thoughts. Bring your desires. It will be a eat while we talk meeting, so we will have a meal provided. Anybody else have any comments for this evening? If not, Dr. Bernstein.
No, I just was going to say, just happened to check my email if you wondered why I was looking under the table to see if I got a response from the auditor, and we have approval for providing food for our business meeting.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. If you all want to bring something to add to it, which we have in the past, it's been kind of a
I did promise holiday. That we would go low cost and reasonable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. With that, I think we will consider the meeting adjourned for this evening. Oh, yes. While we have that, let's do this.
Did you have it?